This episode of Fermented Adventure the Podcast is sponsored by Brewskits, handcrafted dog treats made from spent beer grains, oats, barley, and rye. No chemical preservatives, a great source of fiber, and packed with protein. Visit brewskits.com to see the full selection of treats for your dog and your cat. Receive 15% off, no minimum purchase, on your first order by typing in lowercase FA2024 at checkout. Cheers! Hello, ladies and gentlemen, craft spirit enthusiasts, and those interested in the intoxicating world of craft distilleries, cideries, meaderies, wineries, and the occasional foray into breweries. It's Rich Shane, and welcome to Fermented Adventure, the podcast, where we bring you the fascinating people that are making the mash, fermenting, distilling, bottling, pouring, and delivering to you some of the finest libations in the world. Before we get started, here are a few housekeeping items. Thank you for bringing the podcast into wherever you are and whatever you're doing. We truly are grateful that you have chosen to listen and make us part of your day. It would mean the world to us if you left a 5-star review. This helps us climb in the rankings, and it makes it easier for others to find us. Don't hesitate to leave us your comments as well. If the podcast didn't meet your expectations, tell us why. We're always striving to improve. You can find us at fermentedadventure.com. We are on Instagram and Facebook as Fermented Adventure. Email us at fermentedadventure@gmail.com. All right, FA Nation, let's meet our guests. He's Scott Perlick. I'm Rich Shane. This is Fermented Adventure, the podcast. Scott, welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, thanks a lot. I appreciate having me here.
Well, thank you. I'm excited. We're talking to a distillery in Wisconsin today, Perlick Distillery. How did all that get started?
It's kind of a long story, but my family's been here farming. We're in very northern Wisconsin, so Sorona. I know very few people have ever heard of that town, and it's literally a few buildings. For anybody that has any context to Wisconsin, we're about an hour north of Eau Claire and an hour south of Duluth and Superior. So that kind of gives you a geographic location where we're at. But there's not many people out here. We are actually, our county has 17,000 people in it altogether. We've got two stoplights that you can see from each other in the entire county too. But again, my family's been here farming for, since the 1920s. Currently, my dad operates the farm that I actually grew up on. He farms a little over 2,000 acres. And so it grows a bunch of stuff, corn, wheat, soybeans, rye, sunflowers, barley. And, this is his idea long, long time ago. But the whole idea is, how do we take grain that we're growing here on our farm and make something out of it here on the farm versus selling it as commodities? Ultimately, when we sell crops, we're beholden to the commodity markets. So we can be as efficient as we want actually growing the crops. But ultimately, somebody else is always setting the price for us. So if we can actually make the final product here out of the grains we grow, that's a huge advantage for us. So because of that, we started this up, or it's his idea. He wasn't going to take the time with everything with the farm to do this, but it's kind of the right point in my life. I can move back home and give it a shot. And that's how it all got started, is we just started making alcohol and figuring it out as we went.
Now, when you say you figured it out as you went, this is a multi-generation farm that you have. And is there any history in your family or in your farm where there was distilling prior or some sort of fermentation?
No, there wasn't. We get people that come by. My grandpa passed away in the 90s. He had the farm. So people come by that know him. I always ask, what do you think my grandpa would say if he knew there was a distillery here? And he spent a lot of time at the bar. So they usually go, I think he'd be probably pretty happy about that. But no, there was no history of distilling or fermenting or anything on the farm. It was a dairy farm previously and crop farm now. So
how did you go about educating yourself about the whole process of making distilled spirits, bringing in the equipment to where the distillery is now?
Right. So like I said, I had absolutely no experience in this. The way we were set up, when we first started out, we went around to a lot of distilleries, a lot of breweries. They all made some really great stuff. One thing that always struck me as odd is they were always in industrial parks or warehouses or right in the middle of cities. And, we always looked at like a winery, right? If you went to a winery that was in an industrial park or a winery that was in the middle of a city, you kind of wonder where the vineyards are, right? Because that's the whole thing with the winery, is you want to see where the grapes are grown. You want to be there and experience that. So you know, when we started this up, that was the main point, is how do we take that same concept as that winery and do it with the distilled spirits, where these crops are grown here. We give them that same experience as, say, a winery or vineyard would. So anyways, back to your point, as far as getting set up for that, it was quite difficult because there wasn't really a blueprint for it. Most of it was you tie into the city's water supply, you tie into the city's sewer system, you rent a place, you know, an industrial park, they're set up for you. So we had to really start from the ground up and kind of make our own way on it. How we did that was we had an old barn on the farm, like a very old barn. It was 100 years old. And we actually used to stack straw on the hay mound. My dad milked cows there when he was a kid, but it had just kind of been sitting there empty. So we're like, well, why don't we try renovating this and see what we can do in here? And so that's how it got started, is a very, very small distillery, very small tasting room, the upstairs of the tasting room, downstairs of the distillery. And, you know, just a lot of research and starting out small, figuring out where we're going, opening up, and then just scaling it up from there.
The idea you mentioned, you grow a wide plethora of different grains. We have vodka here to try today, and a wonderful flavored vodka. I can't wait to try this. With what you produce, is the concept that you or are going to be or have already started to create some brown spirits or some other spirits in the line?
Yeah. So, you know, when we started this out, my idea was, if we can't make it with making vodka, we shouldn't be in this business. And I know that's very counterintuitive to what most distilleries and I've talked to have thought and their thoughts on it. But, you know, if we're making a product, we should be able to be sustainable on it. And so that's why we really focus on the vodka. And fortunately, you know, there's been a huge demand for it. We have our tasting room here. We go through a ton there. We distribute throughout the state with Bill's Distributing. So we're in probably 400 or 500 different retail locations all over the state. And we do that all with just the vodka. So I'm really happy with that. But we do have a whiskey. And actually, just before coming on this podcast here, I'm filtering whiskey because Thursday we have our next release for it. And I need to get that in bottles and actually have people when I've told is going to be out. But yeah, so we do an American single malt whiskey. And we started that. We let it age for 5 years. We started that probably 7 years ago. And so we grow barley here. And like I said, everything that goes into what we make, we grow, including the barley and the malt barley. So we grow barley. We have that malted at Malt Works over in Detroit Lakes, Minnesota, northern Minnesota. And then we bring that back here and we use that barley in our vodka. We also use it in this American single malt. So we malt that into a Pilsner malt. And that's what we use for our whiskey.
I didn't see that single malt in the box, or else I would have had it available for tasting on the podcast today. But the way you describe it and the connection with the land and how you approach distilling, you are literally a seed to bottle to glass farm. With all that being said, what is the family? You know, how did you end up in Wisconsin, or, you know, what's the basic history and the pride that you take in your family, the Perlick family, for coming to Wisconsin?
Right. So it was German and Norwegian immigrants back in the 20s. And, you know, Wisconsin's very well known as a dairy state and dairy farms. And back then, you know, everyone had, you know, 50, 60 acres and a few and 20, 30 dairy cows. And that was what a majority of people did here. So my family kind of, you know, fell into that. And there's quite a bit of history with it too. But, you know, where it really took off on the farming side of things is when my grandpa passed away in the 90s, my dad took over the farm. He's an agronomist by trade. And for anyone that doesn't know what an agronomist is, I always say it's like a plant doctor, right? He tells farmers what's wrong with their plants, how to make them grow better, everything else. So he took over the farm and really started cash crop and growing the farm. So that's, you know, where the growth actually happened that allowed this distillery to happen. It's our farm. I grew up here. My dad grew up here. My kids are growing up here, and we don't all just live on one building on the farm. I promise you that we're spread out, but, you know, it is the family farm. The distillery is not exactly on the farm. We're about, a quarter mile away, just down the road, just, on the other side of a field from the farm. We can still see the farm and everything, but we're not right in the middle of everything that's going on there. And, it's the land and it's growing everything that goes into this. And it's something we could do that was quite unique and figured it was something definitely worth doing.
With being a distillery in Wisconsin, I'm familiar with a number of states and how it works. Have there been some regulations that you've had to help recreate, some laws to get passed? Is it something that applies to a farm? How has it been for you to be able to open up the distillery and do sales and distribution? Has it been an easy way to go? Have there been some challenges along the way?
I mean, looking back now, I'd say it was relatively easy, but I guess that goes with anything, right? You start, you do it, and it's hard at the time, and then the further you get from it, the easier it seems. You know, it's just like any other distiller. You have to deal with the federal stuff, the state stuff, the permitting. One of the problems that we had here is being rural. There wasn't, again, the blueprint for how we set up a distillery, right? So I'll give you an easy example is like I said, most distilleries are right on in the city. They hook up to the city sewer. Here we have mound systems. And I don't know if you're familiar with what a mound system is, but we don't have a city sewer to hook up to. So we have to deal with our wastewater here. And one of the ways to do that is a mound system. But because we were the first distillery in Wisconsin to have a mound system, nobody knew what to do with it. So, you know, like little things like that always were a headache. You know, fire regulations, most fire regulations are made so it doesn't burn down the building next door. There's no buildings next door here yet. We still have to follow all the fire regulations. So, yeah, there's just a lot of stuff like that as far as permitting. But other than that, it's no different than doing it anywhere else, I suppose.
Your mindset was, look, if we can't make vodka and do well with vodka, you're not going to do anything else.
Right.
In that idea, what were some of those, or what are some of those aha moments, those opportunities of feedback where you knew you were on the right track and you were actually hitting on all cylinders and this was, you know, received by the market?
Right. We kind of had a nice niche here. So even though I say we're kind of in the middle of nowhere, we have a huge population center in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and the suburbs there, Madison, Milwaukee, and then Chicago. And a lot is kind of tradition that they have cabins in our area. We've got a ton of lakes here, ton of cabins. So it's kind of a vacation area. And, you know, when we started up, we were going to bottle, distribute, have a tasting room. I figured people come by and would, you know, try the vodka, maybe buy a bottle and take off. One of the things that really struck me and really has helped us out is the tasting room really took off on its own. And we say tasting room, it's more of a bar now, even though we're not open until 2 a.m. or anything like that. But because of our setting and because of that vineyard type feel, it really attracted a lot of people that, you know, there just wasn't anything like that up here. And it was really cool to see them appreciate that and come out here and do that. So, I mean, we went from a 12 seats in our original tasting room and a bar with about five seats at the bar. Since then, we've expanded. We've got two bars now, actually, one with about 30 seats in it, another one with about 50 seats in it. We've got an outside area, probably a 4,000 square foot deck and patio, another acre of land that has, or just grass that has just picnic tables and that type of stuff on it. It's really amazed me how many people enjoy coming here, drinking the cocktails, and we've really just focused on that versus focused on distributing, because that's, you know, that seemed to be what people liked. So that was something that really, really surprised me, and definitely something, especially with vodka, because it's so versatile, we can make a ton of cocktails with it, right? And we try to keep our menu limited, but we change up our cocktails every season. So every 3 months, we do 4 or 5 brand new cocktails and really try to get creative on it. And people seem to really appreciate that.
I took a look at your website, and to see this tasting room, this facility, it's just breathtaking. And I can only imagine being there on that outside deck, watching, you know, the sunset, or people just have a good time and play. You do food trucks. You really make it a special event for people when they come to the distillery. With Wisconsin, are you allowed to bring in, do you have to make your own mixers, your own tinctures, your own bitters? How is it so that when you're creating those seasonal cocktails, is it something you're limited to, or you have a good palate to choose from?
So actually, up until May 1st, we are only able to sell what we produce here. There was actually just some legislation that got passed called the Wisconsin Alcohol Reform Act. That really changed all aspects of alcohol manufacture, distribution, retail, and it's going to be really, really beneficial for us. So once that goes through on May 1st, we can start carrying beer and wine here and other spirits. And so we're lined up and set up to do that. So we have, you know, a small selection of beer that we'll be coming out with. Our wine, we really wanted to create, you know, a good wine selection. So we've got some very good wines coming out from there. But even with that, we're going to continue to do what we've been doing with our cocktails. And so we can carry bitters and things like that, but I can't bring in basically anything that would be sold in a liquor store. Right. And so that does limit us. On the other hand, it really makes us get creative on things. So we do a lot of infusions. So we do like our Bloody Marys. We've got garlic infused horseradish, habanero, dill, a whole bunch of stuff, right? So people really, really enjoy the Bloody Marys. We do different off-the-wall infusions with different cocktails too. So we've done one that we do kind of like our maple-flavored vodka, which I hope we talk about later here, but we do a honey flavored vodka. So we actually mix honey right with the vodka and pour that. So we're able to create just a ton of different flavors with what we actually have here and not have to worry about the other alcohols and stuff either.
Brewskits, beer, grain, dog bones, brewskits, your dog will go wild. Brewskits, beer, grain, dog bones, a healthy alternative for your pup.
Brewskits are all natural and made in the USA. Visit brewskit.com. That's brewskit.com.
The exact day that you fired up the still, what day was that? Do you remember?
I don't remember the exact day because there was a little bit of experimenting, right? So I don't know what the exact day was. I know it was May 20th that we actually opened the tasting room to the public. May 20th of 2015.
Now, I'm curious as to your friends or people that knew you growing up. You were a farmer and now you're a distiller. And how are you received as, you know, introducing yourself as, hey, it's Scott the distiller now?
Well, so from my aspect, I don't really do a whole lot with the farm right now. You know, eventually we'll get back into it. But from my end, I grew up here. I graduated here, went off to the military, was in the Air Force for quite a while, ended up going to undergrad and getting a bachelor degree. Ended up going to law school and getting a law degree. And that's when I can move back home and started up the distillery. So it was either, okay, go practice law or try the distillery now. I'm a recent broke law grad with no idea what I'm going to do. So if the distillery doesn't work out, well, I'm in the same spot. Right? And so that was kind of the thought of it. So I had been away for a little while. Coming back though, people really seem to appreciate having this here. We were a little worried about it if it turned out some of the bars and restaurants in the area, just because it was so different. But it's been very well received. People really like to see that, like, even in Washburn County, even in northern Wisconsin, we can produce something that's grown here, that's made here, that is local people serving it, local ingredients going into it. And it's been really well received. So,
all right. I've been nosing your vodka while we've been speaking. I've enjoyed the nose. I haven't tasted it yet. I haven't tried it yet. Now, this is American Yeoman vodka. What's a yeoman?
So when we started this up, you know, like I said, this was almost 10 years ago. And I was, 10 years ago when we were starting to figure this out. And I was looking at, you know, Grey Goose or Tito's or whatever. And nobody cared about where that was actually distilled, the distillery that was making it, right? So anymore, we see most distilleries will say, you know, whatever the distillery's name is, vodka. But I figured that just wasn't the case. If we were going to be distributing this stuff, what did it matter? We'd be Perlick Distillery and come up with a brand name. And I actually want to call it Farmer's Vodka because we're farmers making vodka. And exclusively, everyone I talked to said that was a horrible marketing idea and they would never sit at a bar and order Farmer's Vodka. And I kind of had to agree with them. So I started looking up synonyms for farmer and came up with the term yeoman. And have you ever heard that term before, yeoman?
I mean, I have, but I try to contextualize it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's where the curiosity comes in as to how you found your way to name your vodka yeoman.
Yeah. So yeoman has a few different definitions. One that we get asked a lot of is it's a position in the Navy and there's no connection to that at all, right? So we're not using that definition, but there's a ton of history of the term yeoman. And what really turned me on to it was I was a class of people in Old English Society, and they were actually I won't get too deep into it, but they were just kind of under the knights. They were, anyways, there's a lot of history with that one. When that transferred over to the United States, the yeoman was a person who owned and cultivated a small farm, and it was a class of people in the United States. And there's a ton of history with Western expansion and an agrarian democratic republic where the backbone of that would be people that owns their own lands, farm their own land, and those people are considered the yeoman. And there's a ton of a lot of written on the what's called the myth of the yeoman farmer and how that fits into that entire context. That term and that word are totally extinct now. They're not really used very much, but I figured it fit really, really well with what we were doing here. And that's how we ended up with the yeoman as the name.
I think there's a lot of strength and a lot of curiosity and character to the name. And the design of the label and how you did that is really captivating. But in your mindset, this is really the idea of a farmer's vodka. Yes. And the way you portrayed it without saying, hey, we're sitting down and drinking farmer's vodka today, it really gives you that sense of some connection to the land, the history, the pride, the family, a good hard day's work to create something special, something of value. Now, you put a label on there. It says, grown climate smart. So give some sort of an understanding of what that means to you.
Right. So the Grown Climate Smart initiative, we were approached on by the DeLong Company out of southern Wisconsin here a couple months ago. And basically what we're trying to do and what they're trying to do is create a market for sustainably grown grains. And what that means is certain farming practices like no-till, cover crops, we've got nutrient management, windbreaks. There's a bunch of stuff that we can do using conventional farming that really conserves the soil, stops erosion, and as far as like the climate change stuff, it'll actually trap carbon in the ground because we're not tilling it up and everything. And so if you follow this all the way back, it goes back to the federal governments, right, trying to create these initiatives, and it's creating this market for these sustainable grown grains. So think organic 10 years ago and how organic was trying to be branded. That's what the DeLong Company and this Grown Climate Smart initiative is trying to do with this type of farming practices. So we started partnering with them, and we still grow our own grains, but they certify that, you know, we're growing it to these certain standards. And it was great for us because we've been doing it for years. So that's what that Grown Climate Smart is. It's basically recognition that we are growing these grains in a way that actually, is beneficial to sustainability and the ground that's actually grown on.
Now I just feel like I'm doing my part. I should get some sort of offset carbon credit for buying this and applying it to somewhere else in my life. Can I do that?
Yeah, I'm not sure about that, but
I don't think so.
It's kind of an experiment for us. We don't really market too much. We don't advertise hardly at all. We really rely on the tasting room for it and people coming in here experiencing this. So it's kind of a reach for us to put these on our bottles and to, advertise like that. But, it's a really good program. And the really thing I think that differentiates it is everyone, it seems in the past 10, 15 years, it's thought organic is the gold standard. And there's nothing wrong with organic. If you want organic, that's great. There's some really good benefits to it, but there's a lot of things with organic that we just can't do as far as conservation wise. If we can't spray fields with herbicides, for the most part, you have to plow them. And plowing really destroys and harms that soil at times. And so there's some benefits to it. And so it's really cool to have that conversation with people to say, look, this is conventional farming, but here's the benefits that we can do because of this technology and because of what we have here.
Pardon the interruption. Thank you so much for listening to Fermented Adventure, the podcast. Could you do us a favor? Hit that follow button. It makes it easier for others to find us, and it helps us climb in the rankings. Take a screenshot of the podcast, post it, tag us, and let everyone know that you listen to the Fermented Adventure podcast. Now, back to our podcast. What's really special about what you're saying is you educate me, you educate the consumer. You take my mindset to another place to better understand practices in farming, to make me more aware. Because as you said, all right, I understand maybe the standard was that some sort of certification of a different method, but this really ties me in understanding farming. And I think that's as city folk, we need to understand more about the farmer farming. And just because you put something that says organic on it, that doesn't mean the conversation ends. Mm-hmm. So I want to tell you, I really appreciate you bringing that to light here. Now, this grain or this, what are you utilizing to make your vodka?
So we use hard red spring wheat primarily. So again, everything is grown here. Honestly, we started using hard art spring wheat because that's what we had and that's what we grew. We probably should move to hard or soft red winter wheats, which is what most vodkas are made of. The hard art spring wheat has a higher protein content, and which means we have less carbohydrates, which means I have less yield. On the other hand, I don't want to change anything because people really seem to like it, and I don't want to change our flavors at all. So we're sticking with that hard red spring wheats, and then we use about 20% of that malted barley in the process too, and then water, and that's it.
What I will tell you is, initially on the nose, I got a very earthy experience on the nose, and there was some astringent to it, maybe a little sourness of it, but it was a very soft nose to me. And you know, I'm going to inject this because we talk about this all the time, that for Dawn and I believe that the whole concept of, you know, and if you're listening to the podcast for the first time, but we've talked about that vodka should not be odorless. Vodka should not be tasteless. We're not living in the 80s anymore. And it's not some vehicle to make a cocktail or just be a mixer out of. And what's really pleasurable that the terroir or the provenance of what you're providing or what you're producing, I can feel like that in a way, that soft wheat that you spoke about, this is taking me to your farm. It's transporting me to say, this is what Wisconsin, the area of Wisconsin, this is what it tastes like. Because it, at the very essence, you're distilling down that simple grain, but you're giving it or taking the character from it and making something that has just a flavor profile. Now, on the I got such a grain forward. It's a softness on the mouthfeel. There's a lot of sweetness here, and I'm curious: does the sweetness also come out or play with the yeast you're using? And have you played around with some different yeast to create this flavor profile?
Yeah. So I'm happy to hear you enjoy it. You know, it was one of those things, we kind of started somewhere, people liked it, so we stayed with it. We don't do, especially with our vodka, because, you know, I'm very concerned of if our vodka tastes the way it does today, I want to taste that same way if someone buys a bottle a year from now. We really want that consistency in our vodka. So there's not a whole lot of experimenting that goes on with the vodka anymore. Unfortunately, you know, we're basically at capacity, so it doesn't make sense to try to experiment with other stuff. At some point, we probably will. Our best guess is the high protein content in the grain, that hard-red spring wheat, brings out some of the sweetness from it in the very end. But if you ask me exactly how that works, I don't know. but definitely we get that a lot. People get the sweetness from it. We don't do anything to add to it to make that happen. It's just how it's distilled, how it's made. Well, another thing that really helps on it is we use our own groundwater here. We are really fortunate with a very great groundwater supply. There's absolutely nothing wrong with it. I hate going sometimes to cities and stuff because I taste the chlorinated water and it just tastes horrible. And we're really blessed with our good water here. And ultimately, that water makes a huge difference in how the spirit tastes, because when we proof that down, that's just the water coming through, and how that interacts with the alcohol really brings out some different tastes.
You talked that you do infusions in your tasting room, and what I get from this vodka is the ability for it to play in a number of different ways in a number of different cocktails, because the finish on this is somewhat more spicy or somewhat more savory. So I could see this with the tomato. You get that, if you talk about a Bloody Mary and the tomato, you do get that sweetness from the fruit, from the tomato. But then in a Bloody Mary, you may want to have those peppery notes, those tangy notes, those spicy notes, that horseradish that you might get from there. And I can almost feel like this will take, you know, this will take me along that journey and be able to be both, because there are vodkas that you'll have that maybe aren't set up very well for a complexity, let's say a Bloody Mary, but you could do something more simple as, let's say, a vodka tonic or a vodka soda, or, you know, something with a little less, maybe a little citrus, but not overwhelming, because then you just don't have anything left on the vodka anymore. And I think this is where this gives that person that's behind the bar, whoever's creating these cocktails, a good amount of leeway, a good amount of latitude to create some different cocktails. So great on you guys.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it's always, you know, I always appreciate it when people enjoy our cocktails, but one I appreciate the most is when I see people just get the vodka on the rocks, or if they just get a straight up martini. And because that means they really enjoy the taste of the vodka itself. Unfortunately, that happens quite often.
Yeah, I can see this. you know, just a little bit. I don't want to, you know, maybe make a nice dry martini because I don't want a lot in there, but I can also really gravitate right now to making this a nice dirty martini.
Absolutely.
And, you know, seeing how that goes with all that olive brine. Ah, you're giving me all kinds of ways to spend the rest of the day just drinking your vodka in different cocktails.
Another thing we do too is on our website, we've got a recipe page where we put actual photos of the cocktails and instructions on how to make those cocktails. So if you're ever interested in trying some of the stuff we know people like here, you can always go to the website there and follow the instructions to make it.
Okay. I couldn't wait. I put this off long enough. I am holding a bottle of American Yeoman maple syrup flavored vodka. And we've tried maple flavored whiskeys and ryes, and we, you know, here with Dawn and I at Ferment and Adventure, we love maple anything. You could probably, you know, flavor maple, bacon, maple. We'll just do maple as it's like that signature, how do you do kind of way to introduce us. Maple vodka, though. How did you come up with that idea?
So I think the way we came up with it originally is we were messing around with cocktails in the distillery. And there's a lot of maple farms up here. A lot of, I don't want to say farms. There's a lot of people that do it kind of as a hobby, right? And so maple syrup flows when it's the temperature goes from below freezing at night to above freezing at during the day in the springtime. And that's when maple syrup's collected. So one of our employees, actually, she was with us for a very long time. She finally retired in the tasting room. But her and her husband make maple syrup, and they spend a couple weeks a year just, you know, boiling it and collecting it, making the maple syrup. And we'd try using it in the cocktails. The problem you have with using maple syrup in cocktails is it doesn't dissolve, right? So it either will sink to the bottom or it stays separate. And it's really difficult, in my opinion, to use, especially if you're trying to make cocktails quickly for the most part, like we're trying to do here. And so alcohol is such a solvent. We're like, well, maybe we just mix it with the alcohol and see what happens. And we did. And it actually dissolves right into the alcohol. You don't have to do anything with it. So we've been doing it as a maple syrup flavored vodka in the tasting room for years, and just using local maple syrup where we could, using it in different cocktails. We had one cocktail, maple and cream. So it's just the maple flavored vodka on the rocks with a heavy whipping cream, a little splash of that. Tastes like a maple syrup flavored white Russian. And so it was always really popular here in the tasting room and in cocktails that we made here. But again, we just weren't set up to do another product, right? So I'd like to say we're a relatively large distillery now, but it took a long time to get there, right? A lot of work and a lot of capital to get there. We were finally to a point where we could actually start producing something else. A little background on actually bottling the stuff. There was a gentleman and his wife, Scott and Sherry Holtz, that stopped by here. They were actually vacationing in the area, and they had a maple farm. And they have a maple farm. They do about 150 acres of maple trees, and it's really cool. I don't know if any of you have ever been to a maple farm or seen it, but you know, the vacuum lines going everywhere, pump stations, the big boiler. I mean, it was the whole works. And they make, you know, 3,000-4,000 gallons of maple syrup a year, but it's still a family, you know, a family maple syrup farm. And the problem he was running into is just like us, is maple syrup is a commodity, right? If he goes and tries selling it, he's totally beholden to Canada and New Hampshire and the prices that are set there. So he was looking for ways, just like we were with our grains, to add value to the maple syrup he was producing. Now, he actually wanted to distill the maple sap into vodka, which was, you know, it could be a really cool idea. We weren't set up for it. And again, we really want to stick to our, you know, our base is using grains grown here to make the alcohol here and sticking with that. So I talked to him for a while. This is probably a year or so of just talking back and forth. But I'm like, you know, we do this maple syrup flavored vodka. We could bottle that. And if you can guarantee me a good supply of good maple syrup, I think this stuff would really go. And so we worked on an agreement. So they supply all our maple syrup. They're about an hour east of us here. So not necessarily local, but there wasn't very many local farms that could produce enough maple syrup to meet our demand on it. So it all comes from him. And basically last year, I think a little over a year ago, is when we released it. And it's been very popular. People really, really seem to like it.
I could see where you're just telling him to keep planting more maple trees. And because this is something that I believe you're going to have people want over and over and over again. And it's, you know, I haven't tasted it yet, but even on the nose, it's not overly mapley, which I was happy about. Maple syrupy. Mm-hmm. It's not like you just opened up a bottle of like a maple syrup So you're getting that sugars and everything in there. It almost has a nose. And I think this is where your vodka comes in. It creates more of a nose of a caramel. Like, mm-hmm. like there's that, the you know, when you bring that caramel up, so you're not burning it, but you're incorporating some toasted notes to it. And that's where that really comes in. So this is like sitting out by a campfire and I just want to nose this all night and just enjoy. This is definitely, I'm going to drink this neat. Maybe I don't want to dilute it too much by putting it on the rocks. This is, they're both 40 proof as I recall, right?
The maple vodka is actually 30 proof.
Or 30 proof. Right, proof. So this is almost like I'm drinking maple liqueur now, right. Or a maple, you know, just a wonderful a way to treat your vodka and the maple together. This is just something very special. And I can see where, you know, when you're saying, hey, how much capacity do we have now to do these two runs? Mm-hmm. All right, I tasted it. I'm sold. We're just gonna back the truck up to the distillery and just fill up as many bottles, as much space with bottles as you can.
Sounds
wow,
good.
This is awesome. Like, this is that balance where I can take this and I want to take it and I want to find a way. I'm going to brine my chicken with this so I can make chicken and waffles. And people are going to want to know how I got that chicken with that flavor. This is a secret recipe right here. So this is amazing. Wow.
Good. Yeah, it's been a very popular drink. It really kind of surprised me, especially on how well it goes. And it's so novel is the really cool thing about it is there's not another, I think there's, from the research I did, I think there's another one in Southeast United States that does something, I think Virginia, and there's one maybe up in New Hampshire, but there's no maple syrup flavored vodka. And then especially, well, I shouldn't say that, there's some, you know, the big time guys that do the plastic bottles and flavor it with everything. Right. And that's just right. Artificial flavor. This is actual real maple syrup that's in that vodka. And yeah, it's been very, very popular. People really seem to like it.
The complexity of this, and as you start to, you know, sip this and just enjoy the earthy nature of this. And I think, again, it goes with what I had on the nose. There's a toasted, you get, I find I get a burnt marshmallow or a very, very toasted marshmallow out of many vodkas. And this really highlights this and brings it out. Is there a plan to take some of that maple syrup and that barrel you're emptying and putting some maple syrup in the barrel that just held the whiskey? Is that in the mind of Scott and what's going on at the Perlick Distillery?
Yeah. So it's actually sitting in there right now. So we have, Scott Holtz, the maple, the guy that does the maple farm. And again, a lot of it goes to his maple syrup. He does some phenomenal maple syrup. So if it was bad maple syrup, it'd make bad maple flavored vodka too. And they do a lot of things, you know, we're talking about that Grown Climate Smart. They do a lot of things on their farm too, that go right along with that. That's why it worked really, really well partnering with them. It dovetailed into right what we were doing here on our farm, the distillery too. But yeah, so they actually took three barrels. We do 30-gallon barrels. So he took three barrels, started aging some maple syrup in here, but I think 4 months ago, maybe. And so yeah, we're gonna bring that back here and sell that in the tasting room as maple syrup stored in American Yeoman, American single malt whiskey barrels.
I want to take a little bit of an Amaro or some sort of a bitter profile to this and find a way to introduce maybe some citrus, maybe an orange, and maybe make, and I'm sure you do this in the tasting room, maybe like this maple vodka old fashioned. Because it has all the character there to do that.
We do actually do that. We have that. And again, it's on our website on the recipe tab. So we do a maple syrup flavored, old fashioned. And we make it just like you'd make an old fashioned with whiskey and just without the sweetener in it because you already have the maple syrup for it. And being here in northern Wisconsin, we have Bloody Marys really, really go, right? People love their Bloody Marys forever. That was our top selling everything every single day, Bloody Marys. Which I find frustrating because I've never been able to get into Bloody Marys. I'll try them maybe once a month, once every month, and I never find it appealing. But we came out with this maple syrup flavored old fashions, and Wisconsin is very well known for their old fashions too, mostly brandy old fashions, but then whiskey old fashions. And ever since we've done that, the old fashions have taken over the Bloody Marys. Right? We sell just an insane amount of them, and people really seem to enjoy them. So,
all right, you and I can keep talking, and I'm going to keep coming up with ideas. But when you said brandy, it immediately made me think of Laird's and some of the things that they're doing there. But this is like taking maybe like Laird's and apple brandy and your maple vodka and coming up with some sort of a derivative of a caramel apple or something like that, which I can't wait to try that either. So we're going to be doing some experimenting, and you'll never know what'll come out of cocktail day here with Fermented Adventure. All right. So you talk about the commodity side, Scott. You talk about you're making a single malt. You've got different other grains growing on your farm. And I know you only have so much bandwidth with your still and what you're doing. Are there other expressions that you're starting to work on and starting to dial in on that, you know, your fans and your consumers can expect?
You know, most our capacity goes to meet the demand of the maple and the regular vodka. We only make maybe 1,500, 2,000 bottles of whiskey a year. So it's really limited on that. Any extra capacity that we have goes into that whiskey. And that's kind of where we're at right now. Again, we do grow a lot of different grains, and that really helps the distillery as well. So for example, we grow sunflowers. We grow a lot of sunflowers, probably 300-400 acres of sunflowers a year. And the first two weekends in August, we actually do a sunflower maize. And so when we're talking about farming and everything, most people do not realize this at all. Farming and technology in farming is just absolutely crazy. We actually have precision planting, and everything is run off of the GPS. And we do the map of the field and overlay that in the GPS. We actually get a company that makes a map of a maize, right? And we overlay that of the field. And because the planter, each planter row is individually driven, it'll actually turn off the row as it gets to that point in the field. And when we plant the field, we're actually able to plant the maize at the same time. So we're not going out there cutting it down, and we can do these really intricate mazes with it. And so we've been doing that the past, I think 5 years. And that's been a really cool one. We sell that sunflower's seed as bird seed. We sell it right off the farm here and distribute it throughout Wisconsin too. Obviously, we can't make distilled spirits out of sunflowers because there's no starch in it, right? We can't get any sugars out of it. It's an oil-based plant. We do grow a lot of corn here, and originally we were going to make whiskey, make a bourbon. What I saw was the market was getting quite saturated with bourbon, so we really wanted to try something different. So that's why we have this American single malt, and it really, really sells. It really surprises me how quick it goes. So we're just going to kind of keep making that as much as we can.
What I find is, and what I, really feel is when I meet somebody like you and I try the products and their spirits, my desire is to see what's next. Because if you're doing all these expressions well, and I know you've had those trials and errors, and there's probably some things that just went into your sand mound, that you didn't say, this isn't to the level that we want to produce. But when you see these things at this level, you really want to, you get excited to see what else you can produce because you know it's going to be at such a high, wonderful, enjoyable level. So I think that's why, the people that come into you and say, hey, Scott, what's next? It's not that they're disappointed or bored with what you have. They just can't wait to see what that next artistic, talent and ability is going to produce. And, look, I say this quite often, we're in Pennsylvania, we've got New York, we've got, Virginia, we've got all this rye producing or production around us. And if you're telling me, you're farming rye, I'd be curious to see what that Perlick distillery rye would be like. Because again, it's your water, it's your grain, it's your hands, making and tilling and doing the soil work to make that rye. That might be so, oh my God, I've never had this Wisconsin rye before. It's a first rate opportunity to try something that has your terroir on it.
So that's interesting you bring up rye, because that's actually what got this whole thing going was, so my dad with the farm, he grows a lot of specialty crops, a lot of soybeans that'll go to Korea, South Korea to be, made into, tofu and soy sauce. They want some specialty beans for that. He worked with some buyers in Japan that were actually going to buy rye from us. And I think they did buy rye. They came all the way here from Japan to buy this rye. And he likes telling the story of that's how he got thinking of doing a distillery or doing something like that here. He's like, if these people are coming all the way from Japan to buy our rye, why aren't we doing something with it here? And so we actually, when we started, we were going to start with a rye vodka, a corn vodka, the wheat vodka, and do all these different iterations of the vodka to get the difference. Because like you said, vodka is not odorless and tasteless. It is totally different. And as you catch those nuances in it, they can all taste very, very different. So we had made some rye vodka. It was good. It was a little spicy, like rye vodkas generally are. But we had the bottle printing got kind of messed up, right? So the bottles were goofy. So I ended up just started selling the wheat whiskey. And it's been catching my tail ever since, trying to keep up with it. So we've never had, fortunately, I've never had the opportunity to try out these other things. And usually, I like coming up with new things. I like trying out new things. But like other whiskey, people say, are you going to make more whiskey? And I always tell them, the best thing that could ever happen to me is I never make another drop of whiskey in my life, because it means I'm making and selling all the vodkas I possibly can, right? And ultimately, when we look at it, that's what we're doing here, is taking those grains, turning them into a product. And the more that product we can sell, the better.
All right, I'm going to have to start hunting around in South Korea to see where maybe there's a distillery with your grain making something, or find some soy sauce. I don't know.
There you go.
Scott, this is this is a treat. I mean, you said you distribute about 400 or 500 places in Wisconsin. How do people get your vodka outside of Wisconsin?
You have to have a friend come to Wisconsin. That's about the only way. So it's illegal for us to, with state laws, to ship our spirits. So we don't do that. In Wisconsin, my only outlets of selling are the taste room here. We can sell bottles and we can sell cocktails here in the taste room, and I can sell to a wholesaler. And then that wholesaler can then sell it out from there. But there's no shipping of distilled spirits into or out of Wisconsin, right? So unfortunately, I can't do that. Eventually, we're kind of passively looking at different distributors, say in Minnesota. We're about an hour from the Minnesota border. And again, that Twin Cities, St. Paul area is a huge population center. So we'd hope to eventually get in there. I don't know. I always look at it as there's about 4 million people in Wisconsin. If I sold everybody a bottle, we'd be doing pretty good. So we got our work cut out for us here in Wisconsin first, right?
All right. For those that want to now make the distillery their destination spot, which airport should they plan on flying into?
Probably to come into Minneapolis, St. Paul. Yep. Chippewa Falls, right by Eau Claire, Wisconsin, has an airport, but and they fly, I think Sun Country flies in and out of there, but it's mostly like once a week to Florida, right? So you might be able to get in there, but Minneapolis, St. Paul would be the place to go. We are super consistent on our hours. We're open. The taste room's open 3 to 7 on Thursdays, 11 to 7 Friday and Saturdays, and then 10 to 3 on Sundays. We keep those same hours regardless. We never close down to the public when we advertise we're open. The summertime is great. You can watch stuff grow. Stuff is just starting to turn green here now. The trees are starting to bud out and get some green on them. The grass is turning green. It's a great time of year. We're just getting out of winter here, which wasn't very much of a winter. There was no snow this year, which is interesting. Any time of the year is a really great time to come up here. I'd invite anyone to come stop by and check us out.
Scott, is there anything we haven't talked about on the podcast? Anything you want people to know more about you or Perlick Distillery?
No, I think we went over some really great stuff. Another thing we have here is some really great employees. I have a full-time guy that helps me out in the back and the production side of things, a young guy that does a really great job, really saves my butt because he does the mashing and the stripping and the day-to-day stuff that just takes a lot of time. In our tasting room, we probably have 50 different employees that help out in the tasting room over the year, obviously a lot more in the summer than we do in the winter. But we've got 3 managers that do a phenomenal job of creating the drinks, of making sure we have everything we need, making sure the employees are taken care of, and they do just a great job on that. So, without those things and, wife, kids, parents, everyone pitches in. And without those, we wouldn't be able to do much here. So, we're really, really fortunate to have all that.
Well, thank you to you, your staff, your family, for all that you do. Thanks for being a friend of Fermented Adventure. We'll keep an eye out for maybe when that next iteration makes its way into Pennsylvania, or you start doing some sort of direct shipping to the consumer, because I think, or more or less, I know, once people start enjoying your vodka and your spirits, you're going to have to make and take care of more than, you know, the people of Wisconsin. So thank you again for your time today. And again, really appreciate that. So appreciate that time.
Yeah, well, I appreciate you having me on the show. And it's very nice talking to you. If you ever find yourself in northern Wisconsin, make sure you let me know and swing on by.
All right. Thanks, Scott.
All right. Thank you.